Ways to identify and treat eating disorders, including bulimia and anorexia nervosa. Eating disorders are very common and often heartbreaking. According to the National Association of Eating Disorders, 20 million women and 10 million men will at some point have an eating disorder. Most who suffer delay seeking help for years or may never get treatment at all. Anorexia is the leading cause of death for females aged 15 to 24, but older women and men suffer as well. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn about warning signs, how to help someone you're concerned about, and effective treatments for eating disorders. We'll also discuss the latest research into possible causes, including a potential genetic link. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Eating disorders came to the public's attention back in the 80s when singer Karen Carpenter died of complications from anorexia nervosa. Since then, other famous people have drawn attention to eating disorders. Princess Diana struggled for years with bulimia, and now the pop singer Kesha is talking about her battle. Yet this growing awareness hasn't made the problem go away. According to the Centers for Disease Control, more than 11 million Americans are currently battling eating disorders, and even more will do so over their lifetime. Anorexia nervosa has the highest rate of fatality of any mental illness in the country. What's the scope of the problem here in Maine? What can be done to prevent or treat these unhealthy behaviors? Joining me in the studio, Kathleen Hart, who is a licensed psychologist and president of the Eating Disorders Association of Maine. Patrice Lockhart is a medical director of the New England Eating Disorders Program at Sweetser. And Christina has a daughter who is dealing with an eating disorder. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about someone you know? Do you have questions about prevention or treatment? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today to talk about such an important topic. And one thing I was thinking about as I prepared for this program is I'm of such an age that I remember Karen Carpenter, and I remember being a teenage girl, and there was a lot of attention around eating disorders back in the 80s and maybe more in the 90s. And there really doesn't seem to be as much attention as there used to be. And I'm glad to be able to highlight this today. So why don't we start with you, Patrice? Can you define what an eating disorder is? We mentioned in the intro it's considered a mental illness.
Well, a mental and physical illness. So it's the crossover between malnutrition, which affects every cell type, every organ system in the body, and the psychiatric diagnoses, which include anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder specifically, with some other additional ones that include things that are sort of a failure to thrive pattern or avoidant and restrictive intake disorders, kids that are maybe picky eaters and have specific phobias about swallowing and eating. So things have gotten much more specific in the past few years, which has helped us treat things more specifically. But it really is the way the brain is affected by malnutrition that causes such great difficulties with distorted thoughts about size and shape and leads people down a rabbit hole of thinking they need to be different in order to be okay.
So it can become a spiral where one starts down this road and then because of the malnutrition, the brain is confirming this behavior.
Absolutely. Nobody goes looking for an eating disorder, and yet there is a lot of stigma and shame associated with one catching up with a person. We hear it all the time and at younger and younger ages, I just want to be healthy, or I just want to eat healthier. So that the word healthy is often a word that we notice if someone has become attached to it in such a way that they end up doing unhealthy things to be different.
And I want to return to that, this idea of how to talk to people and talk to children about healthy eating. Kathleen, the three eating disorders we hear most about seem to be anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating. Can you talk about what they are, how they're related to each other, or how they're different?
Well, I may want to go back to sort of the idea of what an eating disorder is. And to add to that, eating disorders affect men. They affect women. It's not a lot of what we know about eating disorders is driven by media. If you could erase 75% of that and insert babies, middle schoolers, boys, girls, young adults, elderly people, it's across the board in terms of who is impacted by eating disorders. The subtypes of eating disorders, there's anorexia nervosa, the bulimia. However, a lot of eating disorders, and actually most of them, fall in between those very specific and rigid diagnoses. And it is called eating disorder NOS, and but they tend to be in between. So you could start out with restrictive behaviors and then end up binge eating while also restricting. So you don't want to get too caught up on the diagnosis themselves, but the behaviors and the suffering that goes on, not only the physical suffering, the mental suffering that goes on with someone when you are struggling with an eating disorder.
And, you know, you're talking about wanting to wipe out the 75% of the information that's out there in the media, something that I've read over the years, and I have a feeling that you would like to talk about further, is the idea that it's a need for control is the root of an eating disorder.
You know, that is one of the foundations that people can identify, is that if life is out of control for me, I will, you know, insert a highly controlled behavior, both a mental behavior and behaviors of counting calories, being overly involved in what kind of healthy foods, especially nowadays where everybody's on, you know, the America itself has an eating disorder in terms of our attachment to extreme health. And it reduces the flexibility and fluidity of eating naturally and eating in attunement with what you kind of want to eat, and having the freedom to eat a wide variety of foods.
It really does end up being a first world problem. One of the studies that occurred happened in Fiji, which was not didn't have electricity or running water or television. And once it did, the television produced a series of generations that had increasing eating disordered behaviors. So it was that comparison model, the marketing of being dissatisfied, that, you know, we don't often pay attention to who's making money off of our feeling bad. But it might be drug companies, or it might be an exercise program. But somebody is typically going to benefit from our being unhappy and wanting to do something different. So really, when you talk about control, that's one piece of it. But it's also a lack of compassion and a lack of acceptance of ourselves as we are.
Lack of acceptance of ourselves. Christine, I want to bring you into this conversation, and thank you so much for being willing to join us. I know it's probably very difficult for you at times to talk about this, but you're in the thick of this, helping your daughter. Tell me what you can about your story and her story. When did you realize that she might have a eating disorder, and what did you do?
Well, she's actually adult age child, and realized in high school, just a very taste of it.
Realized, or you did as her mom?
It was brought to my attention through somebody at school. A teacher at school brought it to my attention. She had heard things from other students, brought it to my attention. I discussed it with my daughter, of course. She, you know, denied it, and it wasn't real, and I was overreacting.
Which is what teenagers typically say to their mothers about everything.
Right. But I did. I fell into that. I took what she had to say. And shortly after that, she did seek counseling, more for, like, anxiety and depression. I understood it was just from the pressures of high school, and I was not really up to speed with what she was dealing with her therapist. She did it on her own, which I'm learning now that that's very controlling behavior, that she controlled the situation.
How many years ago was this?
This was probably 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, And so it was off and on. Again, she was reaching adulthood. She went away to college. I felt like it got better in college. And she graduated from college, you know, got a job, she lived on her own. And that's the hardest part for me as a parent with an adult child. She's on her own. I don't see everything, again, where the controlling behaviors happen. I'm not aware. She's not telling me. And then at one point she was in a program, not a residential program, but a daily program at Mercy. And halfway through the program, she was being pressured to let her family know. And she's an adult. She didn't need my, you know, sign off on medical forms. She called and let me know. And it's like my world came crashing down at that point. It all came together.
How is she doing today?
She is struggling today. Mm. She went through that program. I don't feel she was fully invested in that program. She still controlled a lot. She didn't surrender her control, if that's a correct term to use. She didn't surrender control, and I don't think that the program was able to benefit her. So she is struggling. It has been, I think, 4 years since she got out of that program. And I thought she was doing okay again, kind of the same things. I thought there were some benchmarks in place to keep her safe. That's what I was told. It wasn't happening. We actually got to a point where we let her know that, you know, I have other children who are home. And I let her know that, you know, if she continued down this path, she wasn't going to be able to be part of our family, so to speak, active family. She'd always be our family, but I could not let it destroy siblings or our family.
What would you say to someone who has a child who's a teenager now, and it's in a similar situation than you were, that is hearing for the first time somebody, a teacher, a counselor, a friend, say, I'm worried about my friend. And saying that to you as a parent, you know, something that's probably very hard to hear the first time, what would you say to them?
I would say if it's being brought up to you, open your mind, listen, even if it may not be that. Take that for what it is and exhaust every resource you have to make sure that that's not what it is, if that's what you want to think. I take it seriously. And I think the biggest piece of advice I can offer is when it comes in terms of the controlling part of it, being held hostage by the disease. I didn't realize that. So things I was told wasn't true. It wasn't my daughter lying to me. It was the eating disorder lying to me. Mm-hmm. I realize that now. That is the biggest, you know, you don't take the patient or this ill person's word for something. You need the medical professional's word, the therapist's word for it, the school's word for it.
Sure. And, you know, my heart goes out to you on so many levels, Christina, and one of them is that it's so hard to raise a teenager anyway.
Yes.
It's so hard to understand what's going on, to know when to react properly and when to overreact, and then when there's something very serious going on, and then something you don't know anything about, and there's a lot of mystery about. But Kathleen, the whole time that Christina was talking, you were nodding. These are stories you hear over and over, aren't they? Yeah. Especially the control.
Well, again, you're developmentally, you're working with an adolescent whose brain is developing. So their brains are, I think of the fragility of adolescence, that someone can say, hey, you're fat, or you have a double chin, or X, Y, and Z about their body, and that can just cut them in half and emotionally. And they're ill-equipped to handle that kind of emotional distress. So then that can then morph into a coping skill. And oftentimes people turn to eating disorder or over control of food. That becomes their number one coping skill. And then if they lock into that one number one coping skill, then they lose the ability developmentally to learn and practice other coping skills as they develop a sense of self. So it can, and then it gets into the point of that stuckness and rigidity, and not the unwillingness to let go of that coping skill that kind of works and keeps them on a life raft, as a client of mine has mentioned. When their lives are falling apart around them, they jump on the life raft of the eating disorder.
And even though to you or to somebody on the outside, they're surviving despite this problem, they think they're surviving because of this.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, Patrice, what you hear from Christina about the 10-year struggle, is this typical, usual? Is this this long-term nature of working with an eating disorder?
Well, it is, unless it's caught very quickly. And I think that's the thing that gives me hope about our experiences of treating younger and younger children. It's terrifying in some ways. I'll be assessing a 5-year-old next week. That stops my heart, because a 5-year-old shouldn't be thinking about being a different size than they are. But on the other hand, getting kids and parents into treatment quickly really makes that likelihood so much less of having it be a 10-year or a lifelong process. And you know, I feel for you, Christina, and all parents, because these illnesses are by nature secretive. And so the isolation and the doing it on your own and the not going to tell anybody is really part of the illness. And you really can't bargain with it. And it's against parental nature to take away a previously successful young person's autonomy. But it really is the only way to get them separated from this illness that's Velcroed to their very skin. They can't get away from it. So it's really inserting relationships closer than the illness that is painful but necessary in order to treat these illnesses effectively.
Is it common for somebody who's suffering from an eating disorder to deny not only to people around them but also to themselves that they are?
Very much so. Very much so.
And you're nodding, Christina. That's the situation. Does your daughter believe she has a problem?
I think she's still at the point she doesn't think it's a problem. I think she's aware of where she's at, but she thinks she has control over the situation, that she's okay, she's not in danger. And that's hard as a parent to see that. I know that's not the case. I know it's because she's ill that she thinks that.
A person with an eating disorder can be convinced, and you cannot tell them otherwise, that they are 30 pounds overweight or just like the sky is blue. I am convinced, and I will, you know, you can't get them locked, get them out of that locked belief system, especially around body image distortion. And that is, again, as what Patrice mentioned, is part of the what happens to the brain when you go into a state of malnutrition. The starvation of the brain then distorts reality.
Well, we do have to go to a break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the warning signs. I want to talk about more about these body image issues, and also how just to talk to all children about body image and how to balance these messages we're getting about being healthy and being fit and the reality of the dangers of eating disorders. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. We'll be right back.
What if, instead of browsing the World Wide Web, we were all browsing Gophernet?
Gopher is easy to navigate and easy to browse.
Because in the early 90s...
Gopher was taking off faster.
Until they made one crucial mistake.
At that point, Gopher traffic on the internet dropped off.
Find out why open source won the battle for the internet next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for TED tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock and again Wednesday evening at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Radio will provide special live coverage from NPR of congressional hearings next week. On Monday morning, starting at 10 o'clock, the House Intelligence Committee is holding a hearing on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. FBI Director James Comey and the Director of National Security Agency Admiral Mike Rogers are among those who are being called to testify. And next Tuesday morning, starting at 9 o'clock, we will offer live anchored coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearing on President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. That's next week here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what can be done to help someone with an eating disorder? In the studio with me, Patrice Lockhart, who's medical director of the New England Eating Disorders Program at Sweetser, Christina, who has a daughter with an eating disorder, and Kathleen Hart, psychologist and president of the Eating Disorders Association of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Tricia Brink. She's an outpatient therapist at her private practice in Portland, and she's treasurer for the Eating Disorders Association of Maine. Tricia, thanks for joining us. What are the challenges that you see the most with eating disorder clients as an outpatient therapist?
See, I guess one of the difficult components, I would say, in working with eating disorders that comes to mind is a couple of different things, but as you guys were mentioning body image earlier, so I guess helping clients and working toward developing positive body image. For many people with eating disorders, working on this in conjunction with stabilizing their eating patterns without compensating in some way through exercise, purging, or restricting is really difficult. So in working toward recovery, this means that your body may also be changing during this process in a way that's pretty uncomfortable for people. Not just physically, but emotionally. So, you know, we're exposed to so many different messages about what our body should look like and judgments that are attached to certain body types, both positive and negative, that it's a challenge to begin to recreate the messages that we want to choose to believe about ourselves. I guess while fighting the constant images and conversations, either through media, social media, friends, family, and then the negative body talk, and body shaming has unfortunately become common talk within our society. So it's really challenging, I think, for clients to be able to fight back against that. I mean, that would be challenging for anyone, let alone if you have developed an eating disorder and have an unhealthy relationship with food and the way that you view your body. So,
Tricia, what are effective techniques to treat people with eating disorders? What do you do with your patients?
Yeah, so there's many different techniques and coping strategies. Some of them are behavioral therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, are both evidence-based practices used to target the developed thoughts, and they help to recreate this belief system within clients. And it's actually really empowering for clients because they begin to take back their body and how they view it and helping them to challenge the thinking that they had once absorbed as their reality and start to create a new accepting reality of themselves. So it's really quite inspiring once you get to kind of doing that work and begin to help them to kind of rework that belief system within those two different modalities. You know, we can be really bombarded by those messages, so to help them to kind of untangle that becomes really freeing for them and energizing and inspiring to watch them begin to kind of create those new messages for themselves and what they want to think about themselves and their bodies.
Well, Tricia, thank you so much for joining us. Tricia Brink, a therapist in Portland who is on the board of the Eating Disorders Association of Maine. You are also on the board of the Eating Disorders Association. I'm sorry, Patrice, you are. Tell me about that. And Patrice and Kathleen, you're both, I'm looking at the board here, you're medical director and you're president of the board. What is the Eating Disorders Association of Maine and how can someone learn more?
It is a very young organization, and we are, the organization is dedicated to the prevention of eating disorders, the dissemination of information about eating disorders. We do a lot of trainings throughout the community in medical settings, mental health settings, and in educational institutions, both in high schools, middle schools, and colleges. We are always looking for volunteers. We try to access information for families who are also suffering. Families are oftentimes looking for resources and don't know where to go. So the Eating Disorders Association of Maine does have a website, and we do try to provide individuals and families with resources.
Is it difficult to find the resources in parts of Maine?
Very. I think it's difficult even for the ones that have been established for many years, as both Kathleen and I have been. We're so busy doing the work, we don't disseminate the information as well as we would like to. I have the good fortune now of having an umbrella entity in Sweetser to start to help us get the word out and also get the resources available in the 100 schools that Sweetser has in-house counselors. But we're, I'm just tickled because I think experts like Christina and other family members are more resource than they realize. And I'm always wanting families to get together, you know, and really talk about how their experiences have affected their family life. You know, I don't think it needs to have necessarily a professional to lead these resources, although it can help at times. The New England Eating Disorders Program that I run is the only one with the higher levels of care in the state, which includes a full-day program. Treatment has gotten away from inpatient treatment to a large extent, except for medical stabilization. And so we've found that having people there for the day and then practicing at home in their own environment is a very efficient and effective way to start treatment. But boy, I'd love to have people stay away from my level of care and be at the outpatient level with Tricia and Kathleen, because it doesn't have to necessarily disrupt your entire life, your school life or your work life or your family life, if it's caught early and treated thoroughly right away.
Before we go to the calls, I want to talk about some of the signs. And then if somebody does have some of the signs, how to approach them and talk to them. So I'll turn to you, Kathleen. When to know, when to be worried?
Okay. So this, the early warning signs of an eating disorder would be when an individual shifts from, a flexible, fluid, spontaneous way of eating to all of a sudden that behavior becomes more and more rigid and narrow. So it may be with the justification of, I just don't feel good if I eat this certain food. And then there become internal food rules. And this is something that's hard to detect unless you're around somebody a lot or are really good at detecting eating disorder signs and symptoms. But just there's becomes a rigidity, a preoccupation about food and weight and shape, and also a lot of thinking and worrying about what you're going to eat in the future. Like, you're going out to a restaurant. I'm going to Google it and look at what they have and what I'm going to eat. So your freedom of eating becomes more and more restrictive. So that, I think, is one of the biggest. And then the mental preoccupation with food, weight, and shape is another indicator.
We've already discussed how many people with eating disorders don't believe that they have an eating disorder, probably aren't going to welcome somebody saying something to them. Any advice on how to approach someone you love about this in an effective way without having them push you away further?
I would certainly get a medical opinion that is objective for starters, because it's hard to deny when your heart rate jumps 20 points when you stand up or you've lost a certain amount of weight from any weight. You know, a BMI doesn't really help us in this. You can be diagnosed with anorexia nervosa at any weight if there has been a significant loss and the change in the thinking patterns. So getting a physician on board, and I think having the docs be aware that they can do great harm by saying, oh, you look great, you've lost weight, when they don't know if it's an eating disorder or not. It's these are the sneaky places that people can say, well, so-and-so said I was fine, when actually it's not so fine. So getting those different modalities is important. I would say parents and spouses and siblings have good instincts if they could get permission to listen to them rather than be told that, oh, no, you're all wet. That it's important just to go, wow, something's off.
It sounds like it's tricky, though, because some of what you were describing, Kathleen, is the kind of thing like looking at a restaurant menu. If somebody is trying to lose weight and doesn't have an eating disorder, he or she might do that. And they might look at a restaurant menu and plan ahead of time, when I go, I'm going to order this, and I'm not going to order this, and I'm not going to make a scene. And that's that. I would say a nutritionist would say that's really good behavior sometimes.
It does get tricky. I think with an individual with an eating disorder, there's a lot of shame that occurs and a feeling bad if you kind of veer off a course of rigid eating. And it's also sort of in the context of if your physician says you really do need to lose weight. In that context, it may not be an eating disorder behavior per se, but we're sort of talking about sort of self-imposed food rules. I also want to speak to what Patrice is saying about eating disorders treatment is a team approach. You usually have a very well-developed treatment team in place, and that includes you typically a physician, family members if possible, if they are helpful in the recovery process, a mental health clinician, and oftentimes a dietitian. And that and usually that is really promotes effective and efficient treatment. And as Patrice said, if you have a good solid treatment team, it doesn't take that long to intervene, and someone can recover quite quickly.
We're going to go to Emily, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Emily. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Emily, are you there?
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've been struggling with pretty severe bulimia for 10 years. And I think that I've never done any actual in or outpatient treatment, but, you know, one of the things that helped me get over this was the family. So early on, family actually made it worse, you know, because they found out and their immediate reaction was like, oh, that's so stupid of you. You know, why are you doing that? This is really stupid. You should just get better. And that kind of stigma that surrounds eating disorders is really harmful to people, especially children and young adults, you know, who haven't found themselves yet. And it wasn't until I got with somebody who didn't pressure me, you know, that I could kind of settle with myself in myself and, you know, address my controlling behaviors, you know, elsewhere. But I wanted to thank you guys for the conversation. Because, you know, the stigma can't be addressed until we talk about this and make it okay. So thank you.
Passing judgment never helps anything, does it?
That's absolutely right. And I think we're finally getting skilled at that understanding of exactly what you're describing, Emily, is, you know, people don't know what to say. If you can't find a neutral and curious place about something that you don't understand, it's really better to not say a whole lot and to be curious about what the individual is experiencing in their own distress, not to ignore it or to back away from the relationship, but to be curious about how difficult it is, because it really is hard for people who've never experienced eating disorder symptoms to understand how excruciating it is to go through it.
And Emily, you mentioned something that really negatively affected you when someone in your family said that's so stupid about bulimia. But I found an article, and I want you all to talk about this. Five things you shouldn't say to someone with an eating disorder. The first two are, you look so healthy. You look way too thin. I'm going to guess here that maybe none of us ought to say to anybody a sentence that begins with, you look fill in the blank.
Thank you.
And there is a term that we use in the eating disorder world is weightism. You know, just making positive or negative comments in terms of just judgment and evaluation of weight and shape. Just it's part of our culture. We're not very shocked about it, but it is it can ignite just eating disorder thoughts or just body shame.
It takes education, just like saying other trigger words of derogatory comments about a person's race or upbringing. It might be, oh, you look great. You must have lost weight. Well, that person might have a new cancer diagnosis. Or they might think, well, what did I look like last week? Or why are you looking at my body? So there are all sorts of things implied in a weight bias or a judgment, good or bad, that is equally harmful to someone thinking about their body.
We'll go to Carol, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to hear this conversation. But I'm disappointed that I'm not hearing any mention of any of the anonymous programs, Overeaters Anonymous, or any of the other programs like that. And I wondered if one of your guests has anything to add to that, because that's a wonderful part of the whole treatment picture, I would think.
Well, I think all of the 12-step programs and their identified goals are very important in this culture. They cause us to think and give us some structure in ways to think about things that have become addictive. I think, again, they all have their role in different scenarios. So if it's a place to try Overeaters Anonymous, that may be a style that fits a certain patient that another patient is not going to benefit, just like any kind of treatment approach. But I appreciate your bringing that up. We had just not gotten to them yet.
Mm-hmm.
I just would like to add to that, though, that one of the benefits of any of the anonymous programs is that you're talking to other people who have the same issue.
Yep.
And that is a wonderful support area that hasn't been mentioned at all.
Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome.
And again, I think it highlights there are different treatment modalities for different individuals. And, there are people who specialize or work in different capacities. And one is the addiction model, which is a very powerful treatment model.
Carol, thanks for your call. We do have to go to another break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the World Affairs Council, connecting Maine and the world with international speakers and global topics. Learn more at wacmaine.org.
Trying to explain the traditional New England town meeting to an outsider has its challenges.
That night he said to me, "Boy, that's pretty Neanderthal." But the next morning he looked at me and said, "I don't get to voice my tax dollars go in Florida. Now I understand."
On Next, we'll stand up and be counted at town meeting. We'll also consider what climate change is doing to ski season. Join us on Next from the New England News Collaborative.
Coming up in 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
Neil Gorsuch is 49, a solidly conservative judge from Colorado. He is President Trump's pick to replace Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court.
The qualifications of Judge Gorsuch are beyond dispute.
Tuesday, senators will question the nominee about his legal philosophy. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join me for gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Gorsuch confirmation hearings from NPR News.
That's starting Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Preventing and Treating Eating Disorders. In the studio with me, Christina, who has an adult daughter struggling with an eating disorder, Kathleen Hart, president of the Eating Disorders Association of Maine, and Patrice Lockhart, medical director of the New England Eating Disorders Program at Sweetser. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email here. Someone writes in, "I have anorexia. How do I treat it right?"
Wow, there's so much in those few words. It breaks my heart that someone feels like they don't deserve to be treated right themselves. And I would say anorexia nervosa, again, it's something that just comes and takes over, and it's not your fault. So if you could bring yourself to reach out to anybody, whether it's a friend, a family member, an anonymous email here, we can get you phone numbers and resources. It's going to be the steps of letting people in that are going to help you treat yourself right and let your eating disorder not be the primary relationship.
Christina, you're nodding.
Well, just like what she said about the steps of letting people in. If she could let somebody in and guide her.
Or him,
exactly.
I do think this emailer actually is a man, and that's something that you all, or male, want to make clear, is that we have this idea that this is something that happens to teenage girls. And you said right at the beginning of the program, oh, no.
Well, with mental illnesses, there's still a lot of shame. If you had diabetes, you wouldn't be carrying around so much shame about your being a diabetic. So the shame really prevents people from getting the help that they need. And if we could all talk about it, be much more open about mental illness, I think we would just have a healthy relationship in general. I mean, that physical illnesses and mental illnesses are one and the same. And we need to be open and talking about it with our friends, with our families, with our children.
And my reading this morning, preparing for the show, I see that there are new medical studies that seem to support there's some genetic element to an eating disorder, which, you know, it seems like early research, but, you know, even more reason to confirm with people that this is something that happens to you.
Yes, absolutely. From many different directions. I don't think the genetic studies are going to be the whole answer. But certainly knowing that it's not caused by you being a bad person is primary in this.
I'm going to move to Portland and Peggy. Hi, Peggy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer and guests. I just wanted to say, because you have used the word serious a number of times. Actually, I'll start with saying that this is very timely for me because I had a childhood best friend who... her birthday is in a few weeks, so she's always on my mind at this time of year, who died of anorexia at 19.
So sorry.
I just wanted to say that it was a long, long, long time ago. I'm in my 50s now. But, you know, we had been friends from childhood until she died. And I just wanted to say that the nature of serious, that the far end of this, you know, maybe there's better treatment today and that wouldn't... happen so often anymore, but to remind people that the consequences, you know, obviously she's still on my mind 35 years later, and certainly her parents were heartbroken for the rest of her life, and she was a very, very beautiful, very smart girl. I just wanted to point out the serious nature of it, that if you know someone who's suffering from it, not to put off handling it.
Thank you.
Peggy, thank you.
Yep.
It's interesting in this culture medically, we put so much emphasis on the dangers of being overweight, and actually the dangers of being underweight are greater. So we have a heightened concern on one end of the spectrum and a low end of concern on the great dangers of having malnourished organ systems, including the heart and the brain and the bones. So... The range of normal is much broader in terms of weight and size than we are led to believe these days. So, Peggy, you speak very eloquently about just how physically dangerous eating disorders can be.
We have a tweet. Can you speak about how eating disorders affect the LGBTQ community?
Sure. I mean... just like they affect other people. And I think, you know, specifically in patients that I've worked with, it's often the lack of acceptance and respect for people who identify with a gender that's different than the body that they received, and thinking that maybe they need to change and adapt that body to fit a different space. I always work with people about accepting the body that they have, no matter what the other variables may be. They really don't matter. I've had some really lovely moments, though, of particularly one young person who was born into a female body and identified it as a male, whose father would not accept him. And the mother was kind of on the fence, and this young person came into treatment and first, you know, was pre-puberty, first was determined to restore weight and safety. And that young man's mother bought him a blue teddy bear, first time ever. And it was the first piece of healing that they were able to do. So sometimes, you know, the eating disorders can be a wake-up call to some serious issues that need to be addressed in family communication as well.
We'll go to Louise, who's calling from Blue Hill Peninsula. Hi, Louise. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. I have to turn off the radio. I'm calling in regard to this. This was years ago, and I want to say that my daughter has grew up and is very successful and has a very, very happy life and loves her husband, loves her job. But she had her dance teacher when she was in 10th grade identified it and told me that her ribs were sticking out in dance class. And And we addressed it, and she went to the doctor, and we treated it as something pretty simple. And she did begin to moderate. She has wonderful, wonderful eating habits, but she is always still careful about her weight. And I'm happy to say that she's finally accepted the fact that she looks great at 112 pounds. In her middle years, she's in her 50s now. I never connected it, but when I just heard the problem about psychological problem, she had a traumatic incident when she was in fifth grade, and we went to a child psychologist with her, and she talked and talked, but we never got to the bottom of it. And then when she became an adult, it turned out that she had been abused by the minister in town. And the bulimia showed up later, the anorexia.
Oh, Louise, I'm so glad that she's recovered from that. And as you all, the experts here, listen to this, do you find that there is sometimes a link between trauma and an eating disorder? You're both nodding.
Absolutely. And I think if I've learned anything, it's to assume that that possibility exists in every person, that there's been a traumatic experience or a series of them, that we would be missing a great piece of the truth if we were to just compartmentalize eating disorders as that's the only thing going on.
Yep. Right.
Yeah. I also want to say that early detection or detection of eating disorders often comes from that person that is either a coach, a dance instructor, teacher. That is such a gift. If someone says, hey, I'm concerned about you, come into my office or let's talk about this. And just the first conversation could be such a gift to someone with an eating disorder. Yeah. I'm noticing you. I'm noticing this change. And then
you can
sort of unearth all this other stuff that's going, you know, the trauma.
Right.
Louise, thank you so much for calling. I'm going to go to an email from Sally. She writes, mine is a message of hope. My daughter was diagnosed with anorexia at age 14. She participated in the day program at the New England Eating Disorders Program at Mercy Hospital in 2005. Her recovery took several years, but she's now a healthy 27-year-old who's made a full recovery. My comment is that she did not get into full recovery until after seeing several counselors who claimed to be able to help with the problem but really did not have an adequate understanding or knowledge base. So I'd like to see the Eating Disorder Association adopt a certification program of some type so that consumers can make more informed choices when seeking professional help.
Yay. We were just talking about a unified approach towards the safety aspect of eating disorders. You know, different therapists are going to have different styles of working with people, but if they can have the safety piece be consistent throughout all levels of care, we're going to do a lot better job throughout the state.
I think to screen for treatment providers who you want to know how often do they work with individuals with eating disorders. And if someone's malnourished, if weight restoration isn't the number one treatment goal, then you might want to consider another healthcare provider.
We're going to go to Robert, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. My youngest sister at age 37 died of anorexia, and it was also severely impacted by her drinking, which became basically her only source of nutrition. She virtually, you know, just stopped eating. And, you know, the real irony was she came out of high school as a full scholarship Division I tennis player. She was a fantastic athlete. And at some point in her life, things just started to unravel, and she was very convincing. She would cook a full dinner, and you'd sit there and think she was eating, and then when you really paid attention, all she was doing was moving food around on her plate. And it got to the point where her doctor told her, you know, if you don't start eating and stop drinking, you're going to die. And my parents sent her to some of the finest rehabilitation centers, and she would last a couple days, and then she just would walk out. But what really struck me from listening to this is so much of the focus was on the alcohol, where from what you're saying, she died because of virtually no nutrition. And
Robert, I really appreciate you sharing your story. We are plumb out of time. I want to thank our guests for joining me today to talk about this very important issue. We'll put links on our Facebook page. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.